From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always a pleasure to have a guest return, especially when they've just returned from a triumphant screening at the Toronto International Film Festival. My guest is director Gina Prince-Bythewood, who tackles so much material thematically. I would say her entire career has led up to her newest film, The Woman King. First of all, Gina, it's such a pleasure to have you back. Thank you. And let's talk about that, because you've been to Toronto before with your films, and this is not only the biggest feature you've done, but this one feels really clearly very, very personal.
Yeah, it was my third time at Toronto. I've loved it every time just because the crowds love movies, you know, when you feel that. But certainly this was a big one, both in scale, scope, and themes, and necessity and pressure. It was a lot. And so to be sitting in an audience of, you know, 1,000 people and hear those first laughs and then hear those cheers was pretty triumphant.
It's so interesting because there is no other filmmaker who has dealt with so consistently the intergenerational passing on of skill, of mastery from one group of women to another. This puts you in a pretty rarefied air.
There are so few of us in this position, and the hope is certainly through the work and hopeful success, as we know in Hollywood, success begets success, that this just opens more doors for others to be able to do this.
But I mean, I've got to think that, and we talked about this on a number of occasions, Gina, but conceptually putting forth a story where it's about women mastering things that are not traditionally thought of as skills that women have and the kind of demands that makes of them. And certainly in the case of the last two movies, about the demands of, we talked about Dave Grossman's book on killing last time. Also, the sort of psychological impact of being expert and maybe even intuitively gifted at a skill that is not going to offer you any kind of psychological growth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing. And I think for me, the fascination absolutely has to do with the fact that these are women and the narrative about women, that women are not warriors, that women are not courageous, that women are not fighters, that women cannot be skilled in any type of athleticism or combat. And I was about to say flip, but it's not even flipping the narrative, normalizing the truth about us is imperative to me. And I hope is the thread of my work, certainly changing, reframing what that means. And in the case of certainly the last two films, yeah, female warriors, the warrior mindset, the warrior mentality is a fascinating thing. And, you know, for these women, their whole thing was literally this incredible sisterhood where you lived and died for each other, that you had this cause bigger than yourself. That was the thing that drove you. And that was a fascinating thing to explore, certainly with these women in a way that I don't think we've seen before.
So often, we've talked about this here before, you dealt with characters, protagonists who have to really embrace their loneliness. And this is about a figure who has to embrace her loneliness in a community because it's a secret. It's a really epic emotional story as well as an epic physical story, isn't it?
I love that you said that, because when I took on this job, when I went in to pitch to the studio of what my vision was, the words I used is I wanted to make an intimately epic story. And that was because there were these incredible relationships within this huge epic story. And for me, there's just a number of different love stories within this. And it's what drew me. And in saying that to the studio, I was making it clear that I needed and wanted the personal stories within this, the quiet moments, the character moments, the relationship moments, to be as big and impactful as the big set pieces. They feed off each other. They should feed off each other. And that's really how I approached it.
Well, so often too, Gina, you dealt with the mentor-protege relationship, and it's a very different wrinkle here on that. I want you to talk about that a little bit, because you got to do a lot in The Woman King that, in a way, it feels like your career's led up to this, that you're able to really sort of braid all these different threads into a whole.
I have said that myself, that I truly do believe all my work has led up to this moment in being able to tell this story in the right way and know how to do it. And it is so much of a culmination. You know, some of the actors have talked about how safe they felt in this environment that I created for them to give these extraordinary performances, and that they hadn't felt as protected and safe in a very long time. And for me, I felt that on set because it was us. Like, everywhere I looked, it was us. And in that environment, and having women like Viola Davis and Lashana Lynch and Sheila Tim and Tuso and Bedu, like, they are behind me. I have these warriors behind me. And it gave me confidence. Their incredible trust in the vision absolutely freed me from what we often as Black artists have to do, is the exhaustion of, you can't just think about the creative. There's a whole other layer of things you have to deal with every day in micro and macro aggressions. But here it was us, and I got to have that freedom to just tell our story in the way that I wanted to tell it, in the scope I wanted to tell it. And that was an incredible experience for me.
We're talking about Justified Triumph with my guest, director Gina Prince-Bythewood, whose newest triumph, as evidenced at the Toronto Film Festival just recently, is her film The Woman King. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. One of the things you said that was really interesting to me, which is, you were talking about confidence, and this is a movie really about confidence and what it does to people, about a group of confident women and the kind of emotional repercussions that sets into motion. Essentially, that's what the story is. Maybe to sort of set the tone as to what a difficult task that was, why don't you tell the audience what the movie's about, and we can then talk about that sort of playing out of confidence and what that does in the social and emotional fabric of the film.
I mean, the story is really centered on an incredible group of warriors, female warriors, who were tasked with protecting the kingdom and protecting their people at a time of conflict with the Oyo Empire, and their fight at the end of the day for freedom.
It's set in Dahomey in the 19th century, at a time where there are enormous social shifts going on too, and the recognition that we don't often see in movies about characters of color, which is their own part in the slave trade, and growing up and having to deal with that too. I mean, there is a lot going on in this movie, a whole lot. And what the movie doesn't do is it doesn't explain a whole lot, but you get to sort of, I felt like it was like watching a Walter Hill movie or maybe Last of the Mohicans, where the characters are explained through action rather than describing themselves.
I mean, Last of the Mohicans was one of my templates, in addition to Braveheart, Gladiator. This is not a documentary. It's a historical epic for me. And I just find, as a storyteller, I just find it more interesting to reveal story through character, reveal information through character, through action. And there are some aspects that we do know because we've seen and read. We don't know about these women. We don't know about this kingdom. We don't know about the Oyo. And I'm saying the majority of folks, because of the lack of history that we're taught. Certainly our history begins with enslavement in terms of the American educational system. But there were things that I didn't need to belabor. You just need one image of us in the Barracoons to understand what is going on in the moment and what they're fighting for. So, yeah, I mean, revelation through action and character is just a much more interesting way for me to tell a story.
I was asking this question about confidence. In making this movie, you've got to have the confidence play out. And then that thing you were talking about, if the actors don't feel that confidence emanating from the center of the movie, which is to say you, then the movie won't have it. And that's an enormous amount of responsibility in addition to the other responsibilities a director has to shoulder. I want you to talk about sort of laying that layer of confidence down so that everybody felt it, because it's an extraordinarily confident piece of filmmaking.
As I said, everything I've done, this is my sixth film. I know what I'm doing. and not only that, I had people surrounding me who believed in me and believed in the craft and believed in the vision. I came in with such a strong vision. As soon as I read the script, one, I knew I had to do it, and not want to, but had to. And two, I was seeing the movie in my head and the way I wanted to shoot it, the way I wanted to cast it. That gives you great confidence because I'm seeing it. That's what vision is, like seeing what others do not. And I knew that in surrounding myself with people who believed in the vision, that gives you confidence. Again, I've been on the other side of it, dealing with people who do not give you the assumption of knowing what you're doing, which so many others get that assumption. I think for female filmmakers and certainly Black female filmmakers, we don't have that assumption, and you have to oftentimes prove that again and again and again. In this case, I didn't have to. The women surrounding me, like, they shared it openly. And yeah, the swagger that gives you, you can't quantify it, but it was an incredible feeling and just made me know and have incredible, like, just follow your vision. All the fights, all the things I have to fight, it's okay because I've got these women behind me that believe in the vision. So you better fight because I have to honor their commitment.
The movie's about that, about what confident women do and the impact that confident women have. And I felt like in some ways, I was kind of watching a microcosm of your own career where you've got to go out and show that in these ways that basically force people to not ask questions about you. And to sort of do this and set it in a historical milieu where it causes more trouble than it will cause even now, and that there's jealousies and envies that turn up in the court where Viola lives, as well as the outer world. Again, there are a lot of sort of emotional notes being hit here that remind me of some ways of the conversations we've had about your career.
There are so many fascinating through lines for each of these characters and what they bring and who they are. But I would say the beauty of this and the thing I did learn on this, which on the surface will sound counter to what I've been talking about with the confidence, my entire life as an athlete since age 4 and playing with boys, because there were no girls' leagues back then, playing with boys and then finally graduating to different competition and going all the way through college, you do not show vulnerability. Never. You don't show it on the court. You don't show it on the track. You don't show it on the field. And that has been ingrained in me. And then to move into directing and into Hollywood as a female director, you do not show vulnerability. You can't. And that has just been my, I always joke, but it's a serious joke. There's no crying in directing. And I say that often, and I say it to directors who ask my advice, young up-and-coming directors, you never, ever cry in a meeting on set, never. In this film, in working with Viola, in working with these women, foremost on screen, part of the story is showing the humanity of these women. These are incredible warriors, and they were incredible warriors and badass, but it was about showing their humanity and showing that vulnerability and their vulnerability was a strength as well. And I was able to take that in and learn that because I had two moments where I did cry. And the first time it happened, it was in my mind, my soul was humiliating, yet it connected me with Viola. And it allowed her to fully trust me as a director because I showed that vulnerability. And then it was the same with some of the other actors. that was stunning to me. And it took me a minute to get over it. But I absolutely do believe that now. And that's not to say trust. I'm not going to suddenly start crying on set. To feel that and act, honestly believe that was pretty stunning to me.
Well, I know you're not going to cry here unless there's tears of boredom from these questions. We're going to take a break. My guest is Gina Briss-Bythewood. It's The Treatment. We're talking about her new film, The Woman King. There's more to come. Stay with us. The tedium's back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is director Gina Briss-Bythewood. It's always a pleasure to have her here. Her new film is The Woman King. I want to talk about this, too, this idea of the impact of feminine confidence. Also, that idea of creating a community of these women, these warriors you were talking about, who finally have to make this, literally, this blood oath, which is about marrying yourself, forgive me that turn of phrase, to a cause. In a lot of ways, it's a spiritual thing. It's a calling as well as this endeavor. There is, for me, this center of spirituality not aligned with conventional religion that's at the center of the movie, too. The spirituality built around trust and faith in other people.
The spirituality certainly started for this kingdom, the fact that King Gezu believed in twin gods, a male and a female, and that is then how the kingdom was run. And that was different than any other kingdom in Africa. It was different than what his brother, who preceded him, did, and then that trickled down into the hierarchy of the kingdom and the fact that this council was equal men and women, and then the reverence that he gave these women in a society outside of the walls that was absolutely a patriarchy. But these women, anytime they went out, were absolutely revered to the point that, as it's spoken in the film, you have to bow your head in their presence. For a woman, and certainly our character Nawi, like, how intoxicating is that to see that type of swagger and know on one side of it is could be a life of abuse and hardship, and on the other is a life of absolute reverence and sisterhood. But there is a cost to that in what you have to give up and decide. You're not going to have children. You're not going to get married. You're going to, as you said, you're potentially dying for a cause, but a cause bigger than yourself. And ultimately, I'm hoping that that's an inspiration, certainly for women, and certainly given where we are in this moment, to be able to look up on screen and see women strong enough to stand up for themselves, to fight for a cause, to come together to fight like that, that I hope is a really powerful message.
Well, I think it's something that you've done consistently throughout your career, which is offering up these dramatic questions that women face that are so often part of drama, but you don't treat it in the melodramatic terms. I mean, it really is a kind of stark question as to who you are and to what you're going to commit yourself. I mean, it's come up in every film you've done, I think. The question for your protagonist, is she going to take the conventional road and sacrifice for that conventional road and, in fact, be subsumed by that? Or will she take the road that asks more of her, but a road that these characters are basically built for, that challenge? Neither of these are abstractions. They're all both really emotional choices to take, but these women as often as not tend to be incredibly rational about them and ask themselves these questions. It fascinates me because you don't play these things out in melodramatic terms, which I think makes for a really exciting and different kind of filmmaking, and I always respond to it.
You know, it's a beautiful thing when people get it. I hope it doesn't fall into melodrama because of the way I approach it, which is my absolute desire to normalize it. Like that you follow your gut and you follow your heart, and that's not always the most rational choice, but ultimately it will be the deeper, more meaningful choice that I believe is going to lead to a better life. I know that sounds grandiose, but I feel like that's the way I live my life. And I want others to feel that, because the rewards of throwing caution to the wind, of taking risks, of following your heart and your gut, it's absolutely scary at times. But the alternative is unacceptable to live a life that doesn't have a purpose, that to live a life where you don't fight for what you believe in or what you want or fight for yourself or fight for something bigger.
I find so often that your films deal with the idea of focus and focus finally for something bigger rather than just competition, which is the sort of thing that we see so often in movies with women, but that turns into sort of petty characters and waiting to be validated by others rather than finding validation in themselves.
What's indicative is, you know, there's a scene between two characters, Azogi and Nawi, Lashana Lynch and Tusum Bedu, and, you know, there's a line that I wrote that Nawi says, "I want to be great. Teach me how to be great." That mentality is something that is not often given to women. I mean, Serena Williams is one of my heroes, and for her even expressing at a young age that she wants to be number one and the vitriol that ensued because she had the audacity to speak on wanting to be great, again, to normalize that within women, that's what we get to do as a director, as a writer, is infuse these messages into characters that then are bigger than me, that have a bigger mouthpiece than me. So yeah, that's what I love about what I do. And my hope is, yeah, if you're connected with Nawi and you hear this young woman want that for herself, and the response from somebody that we respect as Ogi is, yeah, I'm going to teach you. Come be like me, who has found greatness. Like, that's exciting to me.
It's a treatment. We're talking to our old friend Gina Prince-Bythewood. Her new film as director is The Woman King. And by the way, I love the sheer audacity of that title.
It's a dope title. And it's interesting because I love it. It speaks to the film. There was a little chatter with some men feeling some type of way. And the thing is, it was real. We didn't make up this title. That was the actual title at that time that was created by Gezu. Yeah, and it was a little disheartening also to hear men be upset by that title.
Well, first of all, let's not kid ourselves. I know you like the in-your-face of that title and the way it makes people react. It's like loving basketball. It's like, okay, I dare you not to take this in. I think too that it's so great to see actors respond to you as a director. And it's funny, and watching a lot of what Viola Davis is doing, in some ways she's doing you in it. I mean, there's this sort of resolute focus you can get. I've seen you do it in conversation. I've never been on the floor with you when you're directing, but she's doing a bit of you in this.
I mean, I'll say the cool thing, and I'm not going to say who because it's part of people's process, but two of the actors spoke on at times the way they stood in the scene was a mimic of how I stand on set.
There is the physical arrogance of the athlete that you have. And it's also about knowing where to stand in the room to if when you want attention and where to stand in the room when you don't want attention. That's sort of like compounded by being a woman of color who's imposing and knows what she wants. So just watching the way Viola does that, I definitely saw some aspects of you in it. And that was kind of thrilling for me to see too.
I love to hear that, but I could never and would never. Like, Viola's process is incredibly, I can't even describe being able to be 3-4 feet from her and watch her head and mind work its way through a scene in rehearsal or when we sit and talk about character or arc. So her process is, if she ever drew anything from me, I would be on the floor because she is greatness.
I'll leave you to be abashed then, and I'll say this, that it's the best performance John Boyega has ever given, because the thing we've been talking about, confidence, you can feel the confidence he has and that he gets from the director here. It's a focal point, but it's not the starring role. But he has a command in this. First of all, he's playing a grown-up for the first time in his career, which is actually something too, but also somebody who's growing into his role as a patriarch, as a politician, as a husband. I mean, all these things. And we can sort of see these things weighing on. We can sort of see the play of thought for these characters, and they're deciding if they're going to mature or not. And it's not just him, but we see it in him. And that to me was a really satisfying thing to see him actually step up and be a movie star.
Yeah, John is phenomenal in this, and he's phenomenal to work with. I knew as soon as I read the script, I wanted John as the king. And it was, I mean, not only I've been enamored with his chops, I think he is, I really do think he is a great actor, but it was a video that went viral during the reckoning.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, where he was imploring Black men to protect Black women. And he thought that that video was going to end his career. For me, I wanted to work with him because of that video. And that's what he brought. There's a line of stage direction that I wrote that says, he walks as if the ground is honored by its burden. And that's John, like the swagger he has that he brought on set, the charisma he has. But he also really embraced this opportunity because he is a leading man. But he came on board this as a supporting role because he wanted to support Viola and he wanted to support me and he wanted to support these women. He wanted this movie to get made and he used his star power to help us with that. And that is a rarity in Hollywood. And he never let go of that mentality. He came on set even when he wasn't shooting to be supportive and be in the environment, to be inspired by these women. He talked about that a lot, how inspired he was, seeing how hard these actresses worked in the training, how good they were in their craft, and bringing that type of energy. Yet also, he is a young man with incredible, incredible confidence, and he's so gregarious. And he dove into this role of this young king in an incredible position of struggle of which way this kingdom is going to go and a decision that he has to make that could end his reign. It was fascinating for him to navigate that, a young king who has bouts of anger, not knowing fully how to control his emotions, his relationship with Naniska. You know, the conversations he and Viola had were fascinating as they built what was that going to feel like and his level of respect for her. So it was, he brought everything. He brought his entire toolbox to come and play with us.
Well, if anybody understands what a rarity is, it's my guest, Gina Prince-Bythe, with her new film as director is The Woman King. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Gina, and congratulations on this film. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis.
Director Gina Prince-Bythe talking about her new film, The Woman King. A hit that should have surprised no one. It stars Viola Davis as an action hero. Other past episodes of the show, several featuring Gina Prince-Bythe, can be heard at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm thrilled to be talking to the writer-director of the new film, Funny Pages, which just in its title alone lets us know his perspective on the world of media and popular culture. The film is, I think, a comedy that actually absorbs the punk ethos of 80s underground comics and turns this into like a punk comedy melodrama. I mean, it goes from references to people such as Peter Beck. If you watch the end credits, you'll see Drew Friedman and Johnny Ryan and Dean Haspiel. But also, I think even the song selection, which feels like, in its way, like punk, a bunch of mono stuff, like novelty records and
primitive R&B from the 50s, sort of interlaced with this beautiful score by Sean O'Hagan that brings to mind for me Ennio Morricone's score for Once Upon a Time in the West. Anyway, let's bring on Owen Klein before we're out of time. Owen, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. Oh, wow. I mean, I'm astonished you really, keyed into, everything. Everything, I'm very flattered.
No, I just saw the movie, but I mean, I do have to say that it feels punk in that way that all that 80s stuff did feel punk, but it's also kind of funny too that it's the story of a guy who's sort of zealous about being a punk looking for a father figure, which in itself is kind of punk.
You know, the film starts, you know, without ruining too much, it starts with a portfolio review and a teacher that's telling this kid, you know, how talented he is. And then it kind of gets dark and you sort of question, the kid kind of questions this teacher who has sort of nurtured probably this underground comics appetite, probably was an aspiring cartoonist himself, this teacher. But, you know, this night that just goes terribly wrong kind of makes him reassess everything and kind of puts the kid in a tailspin. It's a catalyst for the whole movie, I think. But yeah, I've never been a good student, college, high school, any of it. But, you know, it's about those couple of renegade teachers. It was always about those couple of renegade teachers for me that sort of like take you under their wing and show you records and movies and books and comics and whatever and sort of, you know, blow your mind. Just losing that figure early on, it's sort of the quest is to sort of find another person like that.
Even if when you're rejecting sort of conventional hierarchical things like high school, when you find that teacher who encourages those things and makes you feel like an adult, makes you feel like you're communicating with the world, it makes you think that there must be other people out there like that. And have that person in your life feels like, as Robert's teacher says to him, it feels subversive. And you're looking for more subversion, especially if you're in the suburbs where even now you still feel like you're hemmed in by conventionality.
You know, I grew up in New York. I never lived anywhere else. I still live in New York. Yeah, I was lucky to sort of have that in school and outside of school, you know, because I hung around comic shops and weird record stores and worked in video stores and record stores and for so long, you know what I mean? Like, it's the same people, you know, Rep Cinema, you know, like going to Film Forum and Anthology and all these places, like growing up. You know, it's just like a lot of the same characters and faces and a lot of personality. It's a lot of personality in New York. So I got to know a lot of these people, these kinds of people pretty early and, you know, paid attention to who was going to what and thinking about those characters, I guess. But I've just had a lot of older figures that have taken me under their wing in different phases. You know what I mean? Friendships and relationships too, but there is always that kind of that seniority factor that's sort of usually, maybe it's an ego thing sometimes. Sometimes it's genuinely just like, listen to me and this wisdom and I know what I'm talking about and you don't want to do this, you want to do this. And, you know, to lose those people is difficult.
But also there's that thing, having early on, having somebody else confirm your taste. And finally, Robert leads everywhere with this taste.
I think that's everybody when they're young, especially if you want to make art in whatever capacity. You can see your fingerprint maybe and your influences maybe and how they coalesce on a page. But you can't, you're not there yet. Your skill isn't there yet. So you've established your snotty, tiny, microscopic, like this is the window that this is what I'm interested in, and anything that does exist like outside of this is bad or, you know, wrong or aesthetically repugnant or whatever. And I think that's a lot of that, you know, at that self-conscious, very vulnerable, formative time for artists where your skill level does not meet your ambition or your taste. You know, it's very, very difficult. And you need those people to sort of like keep you on. I've found you, those people, they have that bird's eye view and can help you.
Sure. I mean, and so much of this is, and I think it's really interesting the way this plays out in the movie, Robert wanting to be seen, like that scene where he goes and he's about to be hired by the public defender and she wants him to do a sketch. And he's thrilled at the idea of getting to do this. And I think that's kind of wonderful because he finally wants to be acknowledged by every. He wants people to see that he is an artist. He wants to be perceived in that way. And that appetite, which is you know, that's the kind of ambition that can drive a comedy. That ambition to be seen by people plays out, I think, in a lot of different ways throughout the film, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I guess that was what I was trying to tap into, I guess. The class clown kind of artist who's in the back of the class drawing this kind of stuff. And I mean, that was me when I was a very little kid. That aspect of it is drawn from my own kind of personal fabric, I guess. It was like, I was just like very interested in like cartoony cartoons and, you know, cartooning with a capital C and the stuff, you know, reading Beetle Bailey and Peanuts in the Paper and everything. That was the like introduction to comics. And so I just really wanted to draw in a more kind of like wacky, dingy, screwball style. So then later on, discovering Peter Bagg was just kind of like, you know, it's like how Crumb, when you look at Crumb and all of those funny animal comics he grew up on and everything, and children's comics and Mad, and how that all kind of got bottled together by him and spit out on the page. But no, like as a kid, like being the person when people kind of realize that you can draw and you realize you can kind of do it and caricature people, or that, you know, like people get really excited by that. It's like, wow, draw this. Can you draw this teacher or this person or something? And it's like, wow, it's very, that first validation. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's like the humorist, cartoonist. I mean, I feel like even, you know, it's tough. People, that kind of style and that kind of uninhibited screwball cartooning style is really, it's not popular anymore. It's pretty esoteric at this point, which is strange.
By the way, it's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. My guest is a very talented writer-director, Owen Klein, whose new film is Funny Pages. I think, though, what's interesting about this is so much of the way you've cast a movie in terms of characters and faces lends itself to that. I mean, there is one sequence when he's sort of introduced into a sweaty basement apartment that could be right out of Peter Bagg or Dan Close or R. Crumb, complete with this constant layer of sweat that could be flying off like beads of sweat in the comic page. And I was thinking about that too when Robert sees his mentor teacher's book, is his collection, and there's a drawing of Robert that looks like it could be, you know, a cover of 8 Ball.
You know, that art was done by Rick Altergott, who had a comic, Santa Graphics, around the same time as Clouds. He went to Pratt with Clouds, and they worked for Cracked in the 80s together, and he was like very kind of loyal to the sort of Wally Wood style, Rick Altergott. But he did those drawings. But yeah, he's just got that. It's just a very esoteric drawing style. And Klaus and him really, I think, influenced each other's sensibilities at a very young age. You know what I mean? We're living in New York at that time. And, you know, like 77, 78, they went to Pratt where I went, you know, discovering the first Ramones record and everything, but also being into all this old wacky kind of stuff, you know, Ed Wood movies and all that kind of Gen X inspirations that we all kind of like, that have been canonized now, of like trash junk culture or whatever. Crumb obviously was, you know, like that. Crumb is like the great connector, I think. You know what I mean? If people are into Crumb or something, then you might be able to have the same similar, I don't know, sensibility or sense of humor or worldview or something. But like, I think that thing that you're talking about, because like that's what's interesting to me about Crumb, is he had such an appetite at such an early age for cartooning and for American, for that, this like older America, and how it kind of all comes together in his work. He just had a very backwards American upbringing because of Mad, because of Pogo and all this, and Disney comics and all of this crap, and how it feeds into when he's writing about our culture as a society. It is this kind of American satire that is entirely made up of a mid-century life in America.
There was something about Crumb and you know, his embracing of that world that he was drawing about, the drawing and illustrating, but also as a creator, being kind of self-critical of his relationship to it. And we can see that, like I said, it emerged a bit in Gasoline Alley or in Pogo. And I feel like it's also in some ways what you're doing with Funny Pages too, with a character who's like trying to embrace this world, but also being, or at least the movie feels a bit self-critical.
Yes, it is. I mean, the movie is sort of questioning that naive impulse to sort of what it means to be an artist. And this kid has a really warped idea of what that means. He's not so far off, I don't think, but he really thinks he sort of needs to struggle and this and that. And there's some, I think it's self-destruction that he's running towards too. I think it's sort of a level of he's been in a suburb so long that it's sort of closed off to the world, and when it opens up for him, he's able to sort of exist outside of the world in some way, which I think is also kind of the archetype of the cartoonist. The cartoonist is kind of on the outside looking in at the world. Did you ever read the Colin Wilson book, The Outsider?
Oh, yeah.
That book really shaped my understanding of that artist archetype and made it palatable as a real, you know, and combining all the ideologies of all of these people for hundreds of years, from Hogarth to, you know, whatever the Beats. That was later for me, that finding that kind of like an actually sophisticated approach to ultimately, you know, how this kid thinks he's going to function in the world as an artist and as a person with an identity.
Well, it's funny too, because what the movie, I think, is sort of getting at, and there's that certainly in The Outsider as well, and then we see the dawning of that. And by the end of the movie, which is a beautiful shot that almost takes me back to The Graduate in some ways, is that recognition of self-awareness. Also realizing that that outsider culture, and then Wilson gets at this, as time goes on, becomes institutionalized. So how do you make yourself, how do you wed yourself to something that both feeds that need that you have to be an outsider or to exist in that marginalized culture, but is in fact subsumed by the mainstream?
Well, exactly. It's like when you make a movie and people think, oh, well, I thought it was going to be this, but it was that. You know, label things in that way, you know, like, and you go, oh, okay, well, you're coming in with this. But you know, the kid is coming into this world with ideas clouded by the past, kind of a mixed up idea of those archetypes of what it means to be an artist, what it means to struggle as an artist. And obviously, yeah, he makes it hard for himself. You know, I grew up in New York and playing in bands and making Xerox comics. And there was like a real do-it-yourself culture that was revived from the 80s in the mid-aughts growing up, you know, in the mid-2000s, I guess. There was just a nice revival of that in the outer boroughs. And I think spending a lot of time at playing shows at, you know, with five bands on the bill, and we're like the people that run the venue also live there in some secret weird closet room space, you know, with like lava lamps and crap, you know, just like, oh wow, okay, this is the way you just kind of live and dive head first into bad thinking if you're around this kind of stuff and going to punk shows and things and like thinking that's, you know, that squatting is cool, you know what I mean, when because, you know, it's like, oh, this is the real thing, these people are real, this is authentic. And that's a 15 16 year old 17 year old 18 year old thing. But I think what you're talking about, that self-conscious kind of, I think that's a very interesting point. I'm a big fan of Gene Shepard, the old OWR.
Sure, absolutely.
He wrote, the most famous thing he ever did was A Christmas Story, right? But he has this great episode called Lightning Strikes the Ham Radio. And he talks about how, like, as a little kid, you're not a part of the world. You are removed from the, it's this thing that exists outside of you. And then at some point, 10, 12, 13, you actually start thinking about the world and you in context, and that's where you start getting bugged. You know, that's where you start having troubles, you know? And I think that comes later for a lot of people, coming into self-awareness of your action. Because again, like the movie begins with this catalyst, starts in this way. And I think the rest of the movie, he's sort of trying to work through what happened in this room externally. And at the end, I think he's actually considering it for the first time, because it's sort of this, the movie's kind of bookended by these drawing lessons. He finds this kind of warped, what he thinks could be his like warped anti-hero that's going to guide him through. And, you know, it doesn't turn out to be the guy, and it kind of knocks him on his ass a bit. And the ending of the movie, it came late. I mean, you know, it's just that first look into the mirror and seeing yourself in the world in some way and waking up is sort of what this movie's about. Not a lot is learned, but I think it is, the movie in a way is about self-awareness in some way, or coming into self-awareness. Because I think everything that he does between the beginning and the end is pretty unconscious.
We're talking about People Who Think Squalor Is Ironic with my guest, Owen Klein. His feature film debut is Funny Pages.
That's not me. I don't feel that way, by the way. I just want to clear the air, which is, you're just tuning in right now, you know. What an introduction. That's where we, you know, you're dropping the needle here.
hey, I just want people to see the movie. Because we got to get across this, the movie's really funny. And we can talk about all the undercurrents, the framing of it. But there's a lot of funny stuff in the movie. And I start off by talking about what I think is a really interesting and thoughtful way to use music. I mean, that mono feel of all those needle drop stuff that you've got, bedded with that really beautifully recorded and engineered score by Sean from Stereolab, among other places. So he's a guy who really knows how to create an aural environment. And so it's like we're going from externally what Robert is sort of hearing or what he wants to communicate to what's going on with him. And again, the idea of finding, and I heard a lot that I was reminded of Morricone, and particularly the Once Upon a Time in the West score. But I mean, that was an interesting sort of sonic counterpoint to create in the film that made me feel like I was in the hands of a real filmmaker.
All I'm thinking about is actually Ducky Sucker. And
Ducky Sucker, that's it.
The great, it starts with, not a lot of Western, let alone spaghetti Westerns, start with a urination scene, and that movie does. And it's one of the best soundtracks you ever did.
The fart sound, wah, 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 and then goes into that lovely sort of invention for John Whistle. And again, all these sort of discordant elements, the sort of punk element, even in Morricone. You respond in your way to punk everywhere, don't you?
Well, Morricone was a punk. I mean, I don't know if you saw the new documentary about him, but he was going as a classically trained, I can't remember what instrument he was training for. You know, he had some sort of hard-ass teacher, you know, some of the music instructor who's just, you know, and there's footage in it. You see John Cage coming to the school at the same time and making all these noises, and they cut to the purest classical teacher, you know, who doesn't think Morricone is ever going to be good enough. And he's like got his head in his hands listening to this. But that was so influential to Morricone that he started to incorporate, you know, playing alongside all these lush instruments and incredible arrangements of string and warm brass, which is exactly what Sean O'Hagan, who's a genius of the High Llamas and Stereolab, who did our score. I mean, this is the guy that almost reunited the Beach Boys and tried to get, you know, Brian Wilson back on track and be the avant pop guy. But I digress. Morricone, and we were listening to that Morricone stuff a lot, and we were thinking about Neil Hefti and all these different Italian composers, really, and doing something more lush. But Sean is this brilliant. He's the guy you bring in if you need brass, warm brass, and string arrangements.
Gosh, there's so much I could talk to you about, clearly. But one of the things that's so much fun about the movie is you're casting not just for faces, but for what the actors can bring to these scenes. What's fascinating about this, too, is in this way, it's kind of like being a reader of a daily comic strip, where each place that Robert goes to is its own separate world. And he's plunged into that in the way you would be if you followed Apartment 3G, I'm sorry to do that, or Gasoline Alley, or Pogo. These places that, you know, are about these worlds in which there's a devotion to detail by the people who live in them. And if you're going to connect with them, you have to connect to that same kind of almost OCD quality they have about being in these worlds. They don't want things disturbed, and there are certain rules. These are universes within universes. And to make sure you cast with people who look like they live in these places rather than actors, again, who have skill levels that they can bring to bear, that just from the way they vocalize roles, we feel that we've seen these people, we know, we hear from the way they even breathe in these rooms. It feels like a very accomplished thing to do.
Thank you. And I mean, I really tried my best to blend first timers, I'll call them, as opposed to non-actors. I think it's like, I don't believe in non-actors. I think there's only first timers. And, you know, the people you want to cast in those roles are the people that don't change a molecule when you put them on camera. I mean, you put an actor on camera, the second you yell action, they step into another zone. And you go, well, why couldn't you just act like the way you were acting before? Why do you have to act, you know? But people that have a strong personality in some way, or that just aren't afraid. It's a beautiful thing when that happens. And I really, you know, I think growing up in New York, is a lot of the extra people, even in a small role, I always think of Jonathan Demme saying, you know, that when you have even a walk-on character, a cameo, just like in that moment, that incidental character actor is the star of the movie. I feel like most things, you know what I mean? It's just like very, you know, that central casting thing of like, all right, well, we really need the really wacky guy, you know, like a really wacky guy that seems like he's like an academic, but he's like angry. And we'll get, I won't insult an actor, but we'll get this or that guy. I mean, like even something at the funeral, you know what I mean? Like I had the two people in the funeral scene. My friend, Randy Costanza, who was, you know, he's sort of like an old indie rock guy that like, he's got all these stories of like, he was just adjacent to so many things. Like he sang in the band Don Caballero before they became an instrumental band, or they, you know, they, drove the tour bus for Pavement and stuff, but he's just a really funny personality. I put him in the movie, and a friend of his passed away recently. And I just said, can you just talk about your friend, you know? And, you know, we filmed him for 20 minutes or something. And it, what ends up being there is the best 15 seconds. You get different performances out of different people in different ways. There isn't one method, and everybody approaches performance and, you know, filmmaking in a different way, in a different style. And I've just found that ultimately you're running towards strong personalities, right? Trying to write for strong voices and cast strong personalities.
Owen, you gotta come back. My guest is Owen Klein. Go make another movie. His first film is Funny Page. It's in movie theaters. You should see it there because it was shot on film. Owen, I can't thank you enough for doing this, man. Thank you.
Thank you. This is such a pleasure. So nice to meet you.
Owen Klein showing his impressive cultural knowledge in his feature directorial debut, Funny Pages. It's out now. Next, it's another treat, The Treat, from New York Times theater critic Jesse Green, showing off his cultural knowledge. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment and The Treat, courtesy of New York Times theater critic Jesse Green, who recently co-authored the Mary Rogers biography, Shy. His treat is his connection to a bouncy Stephen Sondheim song that showed up in places it maybe shouldn't have.
This is Jesse Green, and this is The Treat. I think for a lot of people, Sondheim is just like a big bag of treats. But I was particularly changed, I would say, by some experiences early in my life having to do with Sondheim. And it's not quite one thing, but it began when my parents went to see the show Company in 1970 in New York. And they, unique to my experience of their theater going, were talking about it for days and days afterward. It seemed to me, well, what was this show that they were talking about so much? And they got the little tape recording, the cassette of the cast album, back in the days when we had cassettes. I played that thing to death, and I just had this feeling that I just had to eat it. You know, I had to consume it. I needed to have the music. Well, the music was already in my ears, but I had to get the words into me. And so I sat there for maybe a month with a legal pad and a pen and very slowly went through every song, shifting the balance from left to right in the way one did on old tuners, so I could hear the words that were hidden on the left channel or in the right channel and when it was polyphonic. And I wrote down the entire show, word by word.
Pardon me, is everybody here? Because if everybody's here, I want to thank you all for coming to the wedding. I'd appreciate you going even more. I mean, you must have lots of better things to do, and not a word of it to Paul. Remember, Paul, you know the man I'm going to marry, but I'm not, because it wouldn't ruin anyone as wonderful as he is. Thank you all for the gifts and the flowers. Thank you all. Now it's back to the showers. Don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
I know this is kind of insane, but doing that, it's a kind of like a ritual of absorbing your elders or absorbing the great ideas in an internal way, not an intellectual way, and also learning how he put words together. I came to understand something that would serve me, I hope, for the rest of my life, that the words are not just there to convey a simple meaning. They're there to demonstrate the meaning and to be examples of the meaning. So, you know, whether it's poetry or lyrics or prose, it made me become very aware the amount of work that every word had to do.
Love is in the air. Different kinds. Quite clearly. people everywhere.
Out of their minds.
Act queerly.
Another treat for me was listening to a song that was cut from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. As it happened, I was directing that show for my high school. So I was very interested. And I listened to this song. It was called Love is in the Air. Very sweet little song. But it was replaced because it in no way told you what this raucous, dirty vaudevillian show was going to be like. It was just sweet. The first lyric you heard was, love is in the air quite clearly. People everywhere act queerly. Some are hasty, some are halting, some are simply somersaulting.
Round and above.
This morning, bachelors beware.
Maidens watch out.
Well, some are hasty, some are halting, some are simply somersaulting. I flipped over that, which is exactly what it's doing. And that was sort of the second proof text for me of understanding how words are not just meanings, but are examples of meanings, that they are the actual, physical, embodied idea in sound.
Love is in the air, quite clearly, people everywhere.
I incorporated that song into my production of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, illegally, and my father, who was quite a fan himself, apparently behind my back, wrote to Sondheim, sending him a program from my high school production of the show. And one day I came home and found a letter from Sondheim in the mailbox with that program signed to me on my birthday. And that changed my life.
Is going around, it's spreading each minute throughout the whole vicinity.
New York Times theater critic Jesse Green with a treat that endures. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the program. It's mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Thanks to Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan for the assist. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Fair warning, my advice to you is gratis. If you want to keep your status, stay home. Don't take a breath. You could catch your death. 'Cause love is around.